This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard, given on the 14th of April, 1957. The title of this lecture is The Reality Scale and the Effect Scale. It is Radiation and Your Survival, tape number 8. Copyright 1957 by L. Ron Hubbard in the United Kingdom. Copyright 1978 by L. Ron Hubbard in the USA. All rights reserved. Unauthorized translation, duplication, importation, and distribution is a violation of applicable laws. This tape is 59 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
The lecture which we are about to embark upon, I hope will be of interest to people who are indifferently acquainted with Scientology, but will be of considerable assistance to people who are professionally practicing Scientology. This is a conference on nuclear radiation and health, but it would be impossible at this time to understand the ramifications of radiation without this brand new pair of data. There are two new bits of data which are of very great importance, and they amount to two scales. And one of them is called the reality scale, and the other is called the effect scale. And these two scales, plotted against human behavior, make a tremendous difference in one's ability to understand the preclear or the person or a third dynamic activity such as radiation. Now, these two scales are very, very new. They are covered very comprehensively and exhaustively, and I hope not exhaustingly, in the 17th ACC lectures, which are being played at the HASI. But I would like to give you, if only a superficial, nevertheless, a comprehensive look at these two scales. As I say, we can't go into them with great depth and detail, but I can give you the salient points of them. First place, what is a scale? A scale is some type of measure, basically. In Scientology, it's also something else, and that is a gradient. A gradient is simply a little bit more added to a little bit more until you get a whole range from a small amount to a large amount. That is a gradient. And the world operates on gradient scales. We go from a tiny bit of something into a large amount of something. We go from a large amount of something by gradients, gradually, step by step, down into a little bit of something. And there we have a gradient scale. Now, a scale in Scientology also means a measure of behavior at a certain level. So we have the basic scale of Scientology. It's the chart of human evaluation, which goes from a theoretical 1,000 down to, in Science of Survival, 0, and in 880 stretches on far south of that down to Hyde, which is about minus 8. Now, these are arbitrary numbers. They are completely arbitrary. The assignment of them, however, was originally done without attention to a datum which turned up later, and that is that these are harmonics. That is to say, when you double one of these numbers, you get into the same manifestation at a higher level. And when you double that number again, you get into a higher manifestation of the same sort. Just like a radio station puts out a signal at 570 kilocycles and is also heard at 1140. You've just doubled its kilocycles, and although it didn't intend to broadcast at the higher level, it yet does, much to the embarrassment of many radio engineers. Now, this arbitrary scale, chart of human evaluation, was compiled from studies and data of a more or less mathematical nature, to give us the reaction and behavior of human beings at various levels of aberration. As we go downscale on that, we descend into lower and lower levels of aberration, more and more complex levels of goofiness. And we find out that there was a consistency. People went this track. And when they were audited, they went back up this track. So the scale is more or less proven by the fact that a person, as he recovers from difficulties, goes into these upper brackets, so that you have a Scientologist saying, well, that fellow is a 1-5. Well, this is actually just Scientology jive talk to most people, but it is a highly technical statement. It means that a person is stuck at anger, and that his reactions are the reactions of anger. And on the chart of human evaluation, that gives us many, many columns of predicted behavior. It tells you what is wrong with him neurologically. It tells you what can be expected of him with regard to children. It tells you what can be expected of him with regard to communication. What will he do? And the only mistake we ever make with this chart is not believe it. Scientologists shouldn't be shocked because of their charitability. But someday, maybe, they are entirely too charitable. A good pattern, standard, straight out of the textbook, 1-1 walks in, and everybody says, well, it can't be that bad. And then they are terribly surprised to find out that under the column of treatment of children, this is what the fellow does. People do act this way. Right straight across the scale. So you have this level, 1.0 is fear. Just above fear, you get covert hostility. And there at 1.1, covert hostility, a person behaves in a certain way. Now, when you audit him, he unfortunately goes up toward 1.5, so he gets mad at you. Well, now, if a Scientologist didn't know that a person in covert hostility, who is making nice remarks to you that cut you to the bone, he hopes. A very mild example of 1-1-ism would be, oh, my dear, what a lovely hat. I have always thought so. This unknown would then make a Scientologist believe that he was really upsetting somebody simply because the person was getting mad. See, he takes a 1-1, he audits him, the person gets mad at him. Scientologist then knows he's making the person better. That's an oddity, because otherwise he would look around and try to find some reason for the person getting mad. And it wouldn't matter what reason, the person would just get mad, you see. A person would tell you he had reasons, but have you ever listened to the reasons of an angry man? They just don't exist. They are completely aberrated. So we take this 1-1, we audit him, he gets mad, and if we didn't have this chart of human evaluation, we would believe we were doing something wrong. We'd probably talk it over with him in some fashion to try to square away his anger and make him get unmad. Oh, no. What would we do if we did that? We would do what everyone has always done to him. Every time he started to get mad, they stamped on his head and says, go back to 1-1, you dog. They tried to put him back downscale, you see. All right, so a Scientologist, knowing this, can bear with it. And up the fellow goes, if the Scientologist is doing a good job, and the fellow goes up here to 2.0, which is antagonism. Goes, well, all right, I'll accept your apology, which you haven't offered him. But I still think it was a very, very dirty trick, you're moving your ear at that time. And from 2.0 and this antagonism, we finally find out, well, he knows what auditing's all about. He's not too interested in it now. He thought he was, but he really isn't. He goes to boredom, 2.5. Now we say, well, this person, if a Scientologist didn't know this scale and follow it, he would say, you know, I've got to make this session more interesting because this fellow was getting bored. Well, the behavior of the Scientologist is raising a person up this scale. And it is not that he is boring the preclear. And this tells the Scientologist that he had better continue with the same process and get him up a little bit higher. First time this was ever observed, by the way, it was in running engrams. And if you run an engram, particularly on a wide open case, you'll find the person go straight up these bands from something like apathy to grief, to fear, to anger, to antagonism, to boredom, to conservatism, to enthusiasm, and then he relaxes and can be happy. And he goes straight on up the band, and running an engram or erasing a mental image picture caused him to change his tone in more or less the sequence. Sometimes we're fooled by this because there are harmonics of the tone scale at apathy. Apathy is all smashed in. And a fellow gets mad, gets sad, gets afraid, gets mad, gets sad, all in an apathetic tone of voice. You see, he's pulling up through these tiny gradients at apathy. And it's quite amusing to listen to apathetic anger. It is a very interesting emotion because he isn't going to do anything. It's how he could feel if he weren't feeling so apathetic. And we see this, and we audit thereby and do achieve a considerable amount of success. Now we're looking at the scale all over again. I merely want to point that out to you. We're now looking at this whole scale all over again, which goes from -8 right straight on through to about 10 or 12. And we're running people up the scale again by click, 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 click. Now, the funny part of it is there's another scale called the No to Mystery scale. That old scale is a parallel of this other scale, but it's quite different. And when we were doing what we called opening procedure by duplication, which we call old book and bottle, you can actually watch a person go up this no to mystery scale. He goes from mystery right on up its various little grades and so forth. But it's a scale of significances rather than a scale of tone. And it's what he says about the objects that establishes the scale. It's quite interesting that he will tell you the various steps of the scale. Even if you get a green man, it has nothing to do, had never studied it. You'd run him on old book and bottle. Walk over to the book and pick it up and tell me the rest of it, and walk over to the bottle and pick it up and tell me something. Walk over to the book, walk over to the bottle, walk over to the book. Those aren't the commands, but that's the technique. And he comes right straight up this, and he comments on various things, and as he comments, you will see that his tone is going up this no to mystery scale. Well, similarly, today in running CCH, we are running no to mystery, and we're also running, at the same time, simultaneously, this chart of human evaluations with its total sub-zero scale. And the first thing he comes up is the sub-zero scale. And we have some beautiful copies of those things, colored, that I was remarking on in the last lecture. They're very funny. They show a thetan in various stages from the bottom to the top. And a fellow runs this rather rapidly. You can watch these control processes run somebody out of the -0 scale rather easily. Well, now the -0 scale became important to us because it explained an interesting thing. It explained no memory. It explained amnesia and explained why people think they only live one life and a lot of other things that we had better not touch on in public. Because you see, a lot of man's behavior is so poorly regulated and so poorly thought out that he can't stand to hear about it. So we do the dodge of saying, well, that's all parascientology. And we don't talk to him about it in public, that's all, because it's something he sort of keeps it in the dirty clothes hamper, you know. And he doesn't want to have it called to mind. After all, he's a respectable greengrocer now. But the reason why he forgets these things, and the reason why he lays aside his abilities and his irresponsibilities, lies in this -0 scale. He goes as a being below death. His body is alive, but he's below death. And when you graduate him up scale, he can think a hostile thought like killing something. But also, he has his memory buried, his experiences and his ability are all laid aside. He considers himself at such a low ebb that he has no memory, no ability, nothing. So it's very interesting to get him out of this morass because he starts remembering things that he probably shouldn't, such as why he had to marry the girl in the last life and other things, you know, embarrassing. We've As a matter of fact, run down half a dozen murders. After Bridie Murphy, some hypnotist reading Dianetics, went over and audited somebody in a hypnotic fashion and found a past life. And he was so ecstatic about this that he just thought this was wonderful, you know. He just drooled. And the darn fool went out and tried to find this Bridie Murphy. Yeah, I think he found her all right. He should have. He must have been stone blind if he didn't. And the person had lived before, and her name was Bridie Murphy. Well, here we go. Over here, with a great deal of ecstasy, a newspaper editor says,
"Ooh, oh my, let's run some big stories on this, and let's find a lot of these and find out whether or not there's any more of them."
And one of our very able Scientologists, Dr. Kemp, went down and told him my suggestion. "Please, please lay off. You will find very rapidly that the trouble is not finding past, getting people into past lives, but getting people out of them." "And there are so many of these lying around that you're going to be embarrassed." And sure enough, within a couple, 3 days, the editor had run up the white flag, had called Ray and had said, you're right. And he didn't publish very much about it. There were just too many people writing in, phoning in. "Yes, I used to be Julius Caesar, you know." We have a new joke in Scientology, you know, in the head-shrinking business. The trick cyclist has an interesting viewpoint. The gag is a fellow standing in the cell, you know, like this. And the guard says, "You know, he's crazy." "Oh, he is?" visitor says. "Yeah, he thinks he's Napoleon." "I am." In Scientology, it sometimes gets to be a contest amongst your preclears, fortunately not amongst Scientologists. He thinks he's Julius Caesar, but he's wrong. I am. It's quite amazing, the activities, behavior, sins, and randomities of the human spirit. These things are quite easy to plot, trace. We know about them in Scientology, and we never mention them in public. And this is not in public, or amongst friends. The point is that certain data exists, and if it exists and you ignore it, why, you have difficulties. Because why? Because you're going on the roundabout of a lie. Therefore, when you're running people up the minus tone scale, you're running them up toward death, which is a lot of recollection compared to where they are. They're so low down they wouldn't even kill anything. You want to get them so high up they don't have to. In between, they may be a social liability. Now, here we have, then, this view of a person unwinding up the scale, getting higher and higher, as himself, as a spirit, as a being, as a, so on. You know, there are three parts of man. There's the body, there's the mind, and the spirit. Now, some of us argue about this spirit until we put it this way. We say to the group, we say, "You all have a body, don't you?" And the people say, "Well, I don't know. I'm haunted. I have a body." Well, they find they have a body. You agree they have a body. Then take them up old Dianetic style and show them some mental image pictures, you know. Show them some of their sins on the back track. And they say, "Well, what's all this? What's these mental image pictures and other phenomena that I see when I close my eyes? Just like you all saw an elephant last night." That was a mock-up elephant you saw, which is a perfectly good elephant. Well, we were calling for another kind. And people look at this, and you say, "Aha, now that is the mind." And they say, "Well, I'm getting real smart. Parts of man, body, that's right. Mind,
Yeah, you're right. There are two parts of man. But this thing's spirit. What are you talking about, spirit?
You say, well, let's not worry about spirit. But you tell me what felt the body and looked at the mind. He said, well, I don't know what did that. We say, you did that. Felt the body, looked at the mind. Something felt the body. Now, a scientist these days got this all taped. You see, a machine runs a machine which looks back at the first machine and then has another machine to tell it that it looked. And this adds up to a fourth machine, which is known as the id. I don't buy that because it seems to breed machinery. There's just more and more machinery comes into the picture, and no actual beingness is ever announced. Well, we just get tired of moving back through the rows of machinery. So we say to the fellow, what looked at the mind and felt the body? What felt the body and looked at the mind? What's going on here? Then we say, now, from that point on, we don't care what you call it. If you say it is a spirit, all right. If you say it's a soul, all right. If you say it's a ghost, all right, maybe. If you say it's a demon, you're probably absolutely right. But whatever it was that did this, that is what we mean by a thetan. And a thetan is a mathematical symbol which means thought in Greek. And that's all a thetan is. It's a mathematical symbol. And you write it with the symbol theta. And that's because we represent this phenomenon with an abstract, you see? Rather than get into a bunch of arguments. Not that we don't mind, not that we dislike arguments, but we like to be understood. We have a peculiarity. We're peculiar people. Most people say they're misunderstood and so forth, and they probably are. And we are the best understood people in the world. Most people go around afraid that they will be completely understood. That's why you have trouble auditing them. So they flinch back against all of this data. But eventually they come around to it and they say, let's see, something felt the body, something looked at the mind, and that something is what you are talking about. Now, if you blow them out of their heads, you do something else with them. Gives them a greater subjective reality. They say, "Wee, what do you know? I am not a mind, I am not a body, but that's secondary." That's as they go up scale, get auditing, they have these various experiences. Well, we're not interested at the basic, fundamental level of that. We are interested in the behavior of this mind, which is a sort of a bridge between the beingness, the thetan, and the body. Now, the body could not possibly be on the minus scale. Why? By definition, it would be dead. But what is this beingness that can be deader than dead? Well, that's merely an observed phenomenon concerning a thetan. He can exist below the level of body death. And if you think a body is remembering anything when it's lying there in the casket, look again. It doesn't remember a thing. But it's still holding its shape and form somehow. And so is a thetan on the minus scale. He is holding his shape and form, which he has none of, on a fixed series of postulates that now he's supposed to be this way and act this way and react this way. All right, now if we understand that clearly, we understand that he is at an almost uncommunicable level. Just as bodies don't respond when we tap them, thetans don't whistle when we beckon. They're deader than bodies. And that's an interesting thing. They're below memory, below analytical action and reaction. In many cases, they are dependent entirely upon the amount of energy they can pour into some kind of body machinery which somehow or other runs them. Now, any Scientologist has objective, subjective experience on this. They know we're talking straight along. The only reason I'm reviewing this rapidly is to bring out to you the scale of reality viewed from the standpoint of a Thetan. The scale of reality goes down well in to the minus zero scale. And the way we can plot that today reaches into the minus zero scale because we are going below terminal with the scale of reality. Now, what do we mean by a terminal? Well, a scientological explanation of a terminal is a complex one, so let's give a careless one here. Let's just say a terminal is a mass which can be communicated to or which can communicate. It's a mass, best way to think of it. And you know these people below that level can no longer really observe a mass. But there is something they can observe below mass. They can observe a line, a communication line. They can no longer see the person, but they can get a reality on the line between two persons, even though they do not see either person. It's very interesting that we have a process that turns this on, not a particularly good process, but an experimental one. We have somebody look around the room and find something that could make an effect on something else. If he does that for a while, some lines start showing up. Just all kinds of lines, black lines or gold lines or something like that. These things will show up through the room. Interesting phenomena. You're turning on the lines I am talking about. He has a greater reality on a line than he does a terminal. In other words, we have Western Union or Atlantic cables or the post office telegraph system. The people on that are much more apt to think of lines than they are stations. See, they think of the wires and so forth. They haven't any great reality on the terminals to which they're talking and a greater reality on the lines over which they are talking. The telephone line is more an actuality to them than the telephone or the person on the end of it. All right. Knowing this, we get not the lowest reality point, but we get an entrance point because just below it, there is neither a line nor a terminal in the estimation of this thing we call fate. We have neither one. A line or terminal. But the line shows up before the terminal shows up. And to get a person to see his body, it is necessary to first permit him to see a line. And this is a very, very useful discovery, which I made here some months ago. Very useful. Because it takes this fellow on this minus zero scale, and it beckons him toward reality. Now, you know that people who are bad off do not keep their word. They make an agreement with you and they do not keep it. They sometimes mistake you for another or don't even know you're there. And as high as they would go ordinarily would be to get hung up on a line someplace. They sometimes think of themselves as messages. Quite interesting. Particles on a line. All right. Now, what would reach such a person in terms of reality? He has neither terminals nor lines. Ah, the first thing that we join with on this scale of reality is line. And how do we do that? With a hand. The hands start to get real to people right in here. And then they start to get realer and realer and realer. This doesn't mean they're terribly low tone when this happens to somebody. Because when you have effective techniques, you cease to be worried about people who are low toned. And all of a sudden he gets more and more, more and more, more and more. See, he has somebody, he shakes hands. And a reality occurs right here. Shakes hands some more, you get more arms. Shakes hands some more, you got more and more arms. And all of a sudden he says, "There's Joe." You get the idea. He had neither lines nor terminals. Now you give him a line, and then he gets a terminal. This is fascinating because it leads upstairs to tolerance of masses. So the first reality, if you can call it that, of a thetan on the sub-zero scale is no lines, no terminals. You exteriorize him and he doesn't have a room. You say, get out of your head, and he gets out of his head, and you say, look around, and he says, yes, I see the hospital. But he's not in a hospital, he's in an auditing room, you see. Now, there is why his reality is poor. He cannot tolerate the objects or lines in the room, and he cannot tolerate looking straight at you, the auditor, and so he therefore has this difficulty. Now, how do we graduate him out of this? Very simply, he starts in without lines or terminals. We therefore give him lines, and he eventually gets terminals. And when he's got terminals, he can get then agreements. And when he can get agreements, he can then get postulates. And between agreement and postulate is that special kind of a postulate known as a continuing postulate, called by us a consideration. All right, there is the scale of reality. It starts at the top of the postulate, goes down into a continuing postulate, a consideration, into that special continuing postulate called an agreement, down into that special thing called a mass, down into terminal, down into no line, no terminal. And when you walk a person's reality upstairs with communication, it can then and therefore follow this track and should follow this track. And it goes from no terminals, no lines, nothing, up to lines, up to terminals, up to agreements. You're trying to run somebody's postulates and agreements out when they can't even find a line. That tells you why we've been messing up occasionally with a preclear, you know. Try to run somebody's agreements out. We know what's wrong with him. He agreed to be sick. He can't find a line, so we're going to undo the agreement? Oh, no, we're not. You're going to have to get the line, reality of. Then the terminal, reality of. Then the agreements appear very real, and then the continuing postulates, the considerations, appear real, and only then do you get him up to a point where he can undo or redo his postulates on his own decision.